And that's one of the things about religion that we have to remember when we're talking about that makes it such a hot topic issue is because we're talking about law. Who gets to be God? Who gets to be God's deputies? Who is the Most High? Who is the divine authority? It's all about the claim to the Most High. The only way that somebody can be higher than us is if we give away our power. Because there's nobody. We're all equal. But we're not equal in our knowledge. So ultimately, I think it does have to be a hierarchy, but it has to be a cooperative hierarchy like a bee colony. It's about what our value system is, what we care about.
Hello, Hive Mind. Today is October 2nd, 2020. I am your host, Nate Kapp. Welcome to the 19th Cubbyhole Podcast, where important topics are unveiled, discussed, and tested. Our website is cubbyhole.com. That's CUBBYWHOLE.com. On the last show, I covered the control structures of the mind control by understanding the workings of the hierarchy and compartmentalization, and how these two generate a dark pyramid structure of a knowledge power differential over those that lack knowledge of how control systems work. Today, we have back on the show special guest Douglas Martin, and we're taking a little time out from mind control and going back into the ancient world, where we will be expanding on the topics covered in the 8th Cubbyhole show, which was a very powerful opener to the Lesser Mysteries. And it's all about the Lesser Mysteries, and if you haven't listened to that show, it won't do anybody any good that's listening to this one. So I definitely recommend going back and listening with a notepad ready, because these topics are pretty dense, to say the least. And in that show, in the 8th show, we began to open up the topics of the ancient Egyptian mythos. And by this, we're talking about the stellar, lunar, and solar mythos. So basically, the science and evolution of the stars, moon, and sun cults. And we covered totemic sociology, the evolution of weaponry, which I hope we're going to attempt to expand on in this show. But those are very important to pay attention to as we go further. And for those who don't know Douglas Martin, he is a symbolist, independent researcher, author, public speaker, and has specialized knowledge in cinematic language and anthropology. Welcome back, Mr. Douglas.
Great to be back, Nate Kapp.
Thanks for coming back on and for being willing and bringing higher caliber knowledge down to this platform for everyone to have a chance to hear. It's definitely much appreciated.
Well, the pleasure is all mine. Yes, helping people get a better understanding of these arcane ideas is really my primary ambition. Not to discourage people from the work, but these are vast topics that require a lot of prerequisite knowledge. So when I'm talking about putting emphasis on scholarship, it's mostly in regard to the diligence of the research. And, you know, just want to suggest that there's more reading and fleshing out the important books involved before we get into the rhetorical stage, that the research needs to exhibit tremendous scholarship and due diligence.
Right.
There's going to be more reading and accumulating research and important books involved than, say, listening to podcasts.
Exactly.
So, everybody has different learning styles, and we got to keep that in mind. I myself am an auditory learner.
Yeah, same here.
And I think that's an advantage because it allows me sometimes to multitask in my research. I can be reading, I can be watching a video, simultaneously listening to a podcast. And the real way that I'm able to have all that going at the same time without one distracting me from the other is because I've already gone over that ground. So I'm really not missing it. Anything that I haven't gone over is where my focus is. But, you know, sometimes my wife would walk into the room and I'd have two TVs on and a computer screen and an audio podcast on with a movie soundtrack in the background, and her head just starts spinning. You know, but I can do that because I've already gone over the information and I'm an auditory learner. But I've prepared myself. You know, like when I first started out with the podcasting, let's say working on Mark Passio's work, I mean, the first thing I had to come to terms with the fact is I simply did not have the attention span to endure and keep up with an 8-hour presentation. So there was a lot of diligence involved in building up my own attention span and being honest with where I was in my own progress and where I needed to improve.
It's the power of inertia.
Yeah, just, you know, I mean, let's face it, there's a lot of things I didn't know. And, you know, one thing that just occurs to me is that coming into new knowledge has a novelty to it. And sometimes that novelty, it distracts us from maybe possibly the veracity of the information, whether the information could be more important than we realized it was or not as important as we once thought it was, you know, because the excitement of learning and discovering new ideas, there's a novelty to it. And I think that's part of the reason that people tend to run with some of their early research, and then they want to be putting it into a rhetorical stage instead of realizing that this is only the beginning of a long journey.
Right.
And not realizing that they're just obsessing over the novelty of coming into new knowledge, not realizing that this knowledge is going to later on apply to something that's more difficult to understand, and that these are maybe possibly only a foundation of something that's more complex. So I guess that's something I've been wanting to try to express. So,
yeah, on the last show, you started out by talking about how materialism causes a degradation in symbolism. And you mentioned the term westing, which you were explaining the movement of knowledge between Greece and Alexandria of Egypt. Can you explain more in depth of the term westing in the sense of evolution and consciousness?
Yeah, it's very relevant when we go into studying the mysteries. So one of the things I'm trying to put emphasis on is that these ideas are much more ancient than most people really have endeavored to come to terms with. The main thing I was explaining is that when we're studying history, it's important to pay attention to where the learning is taking place, and that history is springboarding off of the Near East and Greece, and the learning moves back to Alexandria from Greece and then sacked by Rome, brought to Rome, and then eventually with the rise of the Roman Empire, we're all forced basically under the banner of Latin Christendom, which is basically represents an anti-intellectualism, which is makes the learning the Greek sciences and Greek philosophies forbidden in the West. So the Renaissance represented a return of learning in the West, as in Western civilization, that is. So this idea of westing, it comes from the Egyptian mythology about the sun setting in the west to its resting place when it goes below the western horizon. That's associated with going into the underworld, which is associated with death. So the idea is that in idealism, if our ideas are moving towards materialism, that's associated with going towards the west. So if we take the first degree tracing board of Freemasonry, for instance, which is one of the essential tools of truth discovery, and all of the tracing boards in the Masonic tradition, for instance, are tools that we will need to flesh out the deeper mysteries. So we were talking about the tools on the last show. Well, we really didn't get fully into what these tools are, so I want to be clear that not to confuse the tools of learning the mystery traditions, which in Freemasonry are geometer's tools and drawing tools and building tools. We don't want to confuse that with the evolution of implementation. So they're both relevant in the sense that everything in the beginnings of knowledge discovery was spiritualized, but at the same time, we want to understand that these in the mystery schools, there's methods, and that in Masonry, for example, the main tools are geometer's tools, but also the trestle boards. And then in Kabbalah, for instance, you have the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. That's a tool, and it's obviously directly connected with Freemasonry, because the structure of the Tree of Life is very similar to the Masonic Tracing Board. So if we take this first degree Masonic Tracing Board and turn it over onto its right side, where we have the north at the top, then we notice that as we go to the floor, towards the floor, that's where the west is.
And this is the first degree tracing board.
Yeah, so the west corresponds towards going towards the floor, away from spiritual enlightenment, back towards base instinct, base drives, base consciousness. So it's associated with the lower self. The idea that we're using the body to serve the lower self and our instincts and our passions and just indulge ourselves in the and base consciousness in the pleasures of life, rather than endeavoring to improve ourselves and ultimately create a higher type through expanding consciousness. So there's a lot that I want to say about Westing. It's really what it is. It's leading us astray from our higher purpose. So what is our higher purpose? Well, in the mystery traditions, what the mystery traditions are primarily attempting to teach is this lost principle, which is the generative principle. So anything that's leading us astray from the generative principle is associated with materialism, which we can associate with Westing, and it leads us literally into the land of the dead. It's literally, you could define it as the pursuit of the grave. Now, we don't see it that way, but it's because we have a worldview that envisions life as either from an atheistic point of view, where death is a final cessation of life, and that's all there is, this idea of one shot and out, or that whatever's going on here doesn't matter, other than we accept some particular belief system, and then we'll be okay in the afterlife, so just set your sights on the afterlife. And again, what happens here doesn't matter.
And just real quick, the eighth principle, for those who might have not have heard the prior shows to this, we got into it on show number 14, I believe. And, you know, it's the principle, it's the lost principle, or the principle of care. So if you want to extrapolate that on that a little bit more to, you know, show how we have wested, or how we have gotten away from that hidden or lost principle, I think that'll really help us, give us a better understanding of why Westing has taken us away from our true care.
Okay, well, let me first say that these concepts here are based on solar doctrine. So solar doctrine is Egyptian mythology based in the path of the sun. And that means that the hero in the hero myth is corresponding to the path of the sun, and then the relevances of its gaining strength or losing strength, the waxing and waning angles of the sun, constitute where we are in the journey. And I just want to go ahead and mention that this is the stuff that all romance is made of. Originally, it's the mythology is made of it. But as we romance the story of the mythology, it takes on different forms. And typically, you know, ultimately, as the story gets passed forward, has the tendency to become so deteriorated it's unrecognizable. So the idea of westing is associated to the solar doctrine because it's regarding the path of the sun. So the idea is that the sun rises in the east. So if we're heading toward the east, we're going toward the light. If we're going toward the west, we're going away from the light.
Hmm.
And then the light represents the knowledge. And ultimately, this knowledge is the knowledge of what I want to say are the mysteries. But the mysteries are basically the components of understanding the generative principle. And we can use Hermetic principles to help explain this, because essentially the Hermetic principles are the seven principles that is encompassed by the eighth principle, which is the generative principle. And of course, so ultimately, you know, there's controversy about what the G in the middle of the compasses and square represent in Freemasonry, and it represents many things. It represents, for instance, geometry and geometers' tools. And this is why we call it sacred geometry, because, you know, it's all, you know, the concept in Masonry is about you're a builder. So in that perspective, everybody is a builder. So we're all co-creating our reality in the aggregate. So we want to be careful about this false, this idea of this in this new age about this false power of attraction, because basically the idea of this false power of attraction is that you just think about the things that you want and then those things are attracted to you. So you're dreaming of having a Mercedes-Benz and then all of a sudden you get this promotion and now you can afford to go buy this Mercedes-Benz simply because you set your thoughts on that. Well, you know, that's related to the idea of the power of attraction, but that's not the power of attraction. In order, in fact, for that to be true, you'd be talking about solipsism, the idea that the world is revolving around the individual, instead of understanding that, yes, we are creating our reality, but that's collectively in the aggregate.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, our actions are affecting others. So we have to take responsibility for that. Because when we adopt and ascribe to these erroneous belief systems, which are axiomatic and become calcified in our mind, it's, you know, it's the way our mind is actually functioning that is creating the experience that we're getting in the aggregate. So the idea of westing is that we're going away from the light. So that's why if you turn the first degree tracing board on its right side with the north at the top, to go towards the west is to go towards the floor, which we know represents base consciousness. So we're rooting ourselves in base consciousness, and that represents the lower self. It's connected to the Setian principle, which is that which refuses to return to source, whereas the Horus principle is that which returns to source. So in a solar doctrine, that the Horus principle represents the waxing angles going toward the light in the solar context of the sun in its highest place, which is either summer solstice in the annual cycle or sun at high noon in the day cycle. And then that's counteracted by the Setian principle, which is the sun, once the sun sets below the horizon at midnight, is its lowest place, corresponds to high noon at its highest place, or winter solstice in the annual cycle, corresponding to summer solstice.
And that's at the lowest
in
place.
The annual cycle. Yeah. So the Setian principle is, you know, it wants to stay in darkness, which is, corresponds to ignorance. So, it's a tendency to abdicate responsibility, but it's also rooted in fear. The fear to face the light and deal with the light is, I'm just trying to make the point that's rooted in fear. And it leads us away from the light. So anything that's leading us away from the light, we can associate with this westing. You know, the idea that the three murderers of care in the Hiram Abiff legend of Freemasonry are apathy, ignorance, and laziness / cowardice. Those are the murderers of care. And they correspond to this. These are all based in fear. Part of it is fear of the responsibility that comes with knowing truth. So, you know, part of the reason we don't have freedom is because freedom means responsibility. I know that people have a misconception of what freedom is. I mean, they think that freedom means they can do whatever the hell they want. And it's time for us to grow up and get past ourselves and understand that freedom is responsibility. And that means responsibility to make sure that we have the knowledge necessary to attain it, which includes a deep understanding of the generative principle, and that knowledge gets passed forward on to progeny and posterity. But it's one more point about this. Everything that's a distraction, you know, is leading us astray. And what it's leading us astray from is responsibility to understand the generative principle. Only when we really truly come into understanding the generative principle are we going to understand why it matters and why it has to get passed forward.
So what you're saying is westing has led us astray from freedom. That's what you're saying, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the idea of, you know, hedonism has led us away from freedom.
Right.
You know, just indulging the lower self in the physical senses and not developing the higher awareness and the higher consciousness, which is typified by the light. You know, I mean, it's you're chasing the sun into the west. But it's fleeting, you know. I mean, the more you move toward it, the more it's moving away from you. It's like luring you astray. It represents the alchemical gold. And it's the idea that it corresponds to the idea of pursuit of physical gold. So the chasing the sun into the west is like treasure hunting. It's the search for the lost city of El Dorado. You know, the lost city of gold. So we're chasing the sun into the west, which is leading us away from our true purpose, which is to develop this spiritual knowledge and this understanding of this generative principle to, you know, in exchange for indulging in the five senses and just basking in the pleasures of human existence rather than taking the responsibility for progeny and posterity's sake.
Since we're on westing, there's some other things that correspond to westing. I was hoping maybe you can extrapolate on those. Like, you know, for instance, Western ideas, Western medicine. You get into primacy in the North, which I know that's a lot more of a vast topic to bring up right now. But I think that, you know, it definitely has something to do with it. Does it not?
Absolutely, it does, because it represents an imbalance of the masculine over the feminine. And the feminine corresponds to this generative principle. So the solar corresponds to the masculine ideal. And the reason for that is because the rays of the sun penetrate. So the solar force is associated with a masculine principle, which is penetration, whereas the feminine is submissive. When you're talking about primacy in the North, that's very advanced, because in order to understand that fully, we have to really fully understand our true origins, beginning in the Southern Hemisphere in Central Africa, basically in the Great Lakes region of Central Africa, and then migrating north. So to fully explain primacy in the North, we have to understand this migration, that the Nile Valley flows north, or the Nile River flows north, and the Nile River is 4,000 miles long, and that the evolution from totemic sociology up to the pinnacle of what's called the Stellar Cult, who are the pyramid builders, it entails a migration up this Nile Valley coming out of the south into the north. So the idea was that the southern hemisphere is associated with the feminine, and that's Chalice, because it represents the lower half of, let's just say, the earth, the southern hemisphere. But it's Chalice in the sense that the earth is spherical, so you have a half of a circle. I'm trying to remove it from solar doctrine, because this is before solar doctrine. So in the solar doctrine, that's the lower half of the zodiac, you know, in relation to being in the north, because that's the winter season. But if you were in the south, it would be the opposite. So it gets very confusing, and we can become disoriented very easily. So what I'm trying to say is the feminine, of course, associated with Chalice. So let's just say inverted equilateral triangle. But as it goes into the north, well, the idea is that when they're in the south and they begin to venerate into the cosmos, they venerated in the pole star. Well, because they're in the south, the initial circumpolar constellations that were venerated are in the southern hemisphere. But as they brought that into the north, at the halfway point, basically they were venerating both pole stars. And then when it ultimately goes totally into the north, they brought the whole mythology into the north and preserved it all into Ursa Minor.
And the pole stars are what? Polaris and...
In the north, it's Polaris.
Right.
But the main point, these are like very vast topics. To give you the full explanation for what they are, we're definitely not going to have time. I would refer you to my first presentation, which is The Superior Knowledge of the Ancient Egyptian Elders. And that's just a cursory introduction to understanding Primacy in the North. But the main thing I'm trying to say here is I'm trying to give you the affirmation that what you said is accurate. Yes, Primacy in the North corresponds to Westing, because it corresponds to a masculine imbalance, because the Northern Hemisphere represents the masculine. So I would go as far as to tell you that this is one of the most important reasons to understand why the pyramids were built, because they knew that the stellar people knew that they were going to preserve all of the knowledge in the north, and they knew that that corresponded to a masculine imbalance. So building the pyramids is partly a contingency to remember that the god of the North Pole has deposed the god of the South Pole, and that has the potential to lead us into this type of imbalance. And I would go as far as to say that they understood what was to come. They understood that there was priests in the priest class that were jiving to move the mythology into the annual cycles. And they foresaw what was to come. They foresaw that once it got into solar doctrine, in all likelihood, it would tip into possibly a perpetual masculine imbalance, which apparently it has. So they were not wrong about that. But what I'm trying to explain here is that the building of the pyramids is partly a contingency to teach us that this is primacy in the north. And if we don't get back to understanding where this came from, we're never going to be able to extract ourselves from this situation that we're in. And you know, this is one of the big points that I was going to make in my Secret Societies Part 2 presentation, is that ultimately you can say that the very first secret society emerges out of the stellar cult when it starts coming into the north, because once it gets to the point of venerating both pole stars in the southern hemisphere and the northern hemisphere, that's associated, let's say, with double axe. So double axe represents Horus Behutet, which is Horus of the double horizon. It's the double power. And this is also associated with double cube. And I want to talk about double cube, or what we can call double square. But this Horus of the double horizon is the first contingency before going primacy in the north. So I just want to make sure and mention that they venerated this into the cosmos before they built the pyramids, and particularly Ursa Minor, because it's the seven. They put it all, everything seven into Ursa Minor, but that represents primacy in the north. So the first contingency that they had for that was Horus of the Double Horizon. So you can honestly say that the development of Double Axe and Horus Behutet constitutes the very first secret society, because that's the contingency before they go primacy in the north. Once they go primacy in the north, there's danger that we're going to go into this masculine imbalance and start this westing process.
So wait. So you're saying this is where secret societies started?
I'm saying this is the very first secret society, because this is the very first need. Now, what I'm talking about is that in the stellar mythos, there's an evolution. So you have an early, starting with totemic sociology.
Mm-hmm.
So from the totemic sociology into the first hero cult, that's the early stellar mythos. But as the stellar phase evolves, that evolution corresponds to this migration in the Nile Valley going into the north. And at the halfway point, when they're venerating both southern and northern circumpolar constellations, that's typified by Double Axe, which is Horus Behutet, and it means Horus of the Double Horizon. And I'm saying that that became the first contingency before moving it totally primacy in the north, because they understood the danger of it. So I'm saying that constitutes the first secret society. So what does that mean? That means that when there is any change in the mythos, there's an extreme urgency in the priest class to create a contingency before it goes totally primacy in the north, and then you have the phenomenon of the god of the North Pole totally deposing the god of the South Pole, which are represented, you know, typically by Horus and Set. So we got to understand, Set is the original primary deity before Horus deposed Set in the north and became primary deity. And that Horus Behutet is the contingency for that, which is typified by Double Axe, because it means Horus of the Double Horizon. And I'm saying, literally, that is the very first secret society, because that's happening in the stellar mythos, because that's the first need for this contingency, where you have this struggle in the priest class to move it into the north. So anything that's taking it away from source poses a danger from straying away from the source.
So this is where westing begins then. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying that the idea of westing is associated with a masculine imbalance.
Right.
But this is before solar doctrine.
Oh, okay.
And the term westing is associated with the sun setting in the west, but what it really means is a masculine imbalance.
Right.
And I'm saying that the stellar people understood what was basically going to happen if we venerated into the annual cycles, which would be basically a lunar and then ultimately a solar, which is masculine, cycle. So the whole concept is a solar concept, but in relation to the stellar mythos, it means the same thing in terms of going into the north. It would be just like going into the west in the solar doctrine, because those things are both associated with the masculine.
Right. Yeah, you know, something I think a lot of people have trouble with, and, you know, and this is the power of correspondence, is to understand how there's a direct correlation, a direct effect, when there is a migration or a imbalance happening within ourselves, it's also happening within the aggregate of the whole world. And you can look at the world as a map of, you know, the world brain, if you will. And I think that understanding this type of information is what helps us understand, you know, what's going on in each one of us, especially each one of us as a aspect of consciousness within the greater, as a fragment of consciousness within the greater aggregated consciousness. It's very difficult to orient yourself, because, you know, these are very heavy dense topics that we're talking about. And it's very important that you differentiate between the mind, between understanding these hero cults, and understanding the moon and the stars and the sun and where they are positioned, so that way we can orient ourselves and understand why the ancient Egyptian mythos is so important to understand and understand the origins. I think you definitely have said it very well about these secret societies, and where they originated from, because, you know, that's something that I've had a tough time understanding, and that's because I just haven't done enough work to really fully understand why the study of secret societies is so important as well, because where it comes from and why it comes from where it comes from, which is what you're saying is the stellar mythos. It's really interesting to understand that it comes from that time when everything was in alignment, and the stellar people knew that this information, this knowledge could be corrupted, and they, as it became corrupted, it had to be hidden and kept secret, so that way the corrupted societies of that time would not, you know, completely demolish that information. And that's why these secret societies, I'd say, are so important in our history. And I think that's what you're trying to say, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to it, in the sense that if we don't really understand our true origins, there's just really not really any way we can get back to the source ideas. And my point is that we can't really reconcile epistemology without reconciling cultural source ideas. So in order to reconcile cultural epistemology, we have to really understand where these ideas came from. And if we run it down deep enough, we're going to find out that they all essentially have the same origin, which is Egypt. So we got to just kind of take our time a little bit with these subjects, because I know we're already saying things that people may not be up to speed on. And at the same time, we want to lay the ideas down here now so we can have them documented and then come back to them and hopefully further elaborate on the meanings and the significances of them.
Right.
But the things that we're talking about, most people don't understand, and there's not a lot of good information out there that you can go find. So the more we study Albert Churchward, for instance, the more we're going to understand what a unique author he is.
Yeah, along with Gerald Massey and Alvin Boyd Kuhn. Yeah, definitely. Oh, Harold Bailey.
Absolutely. And those are the primary authors that I'm working with. They're not all of the authors that I'm working with, but those are the ones I would put the most emphasis on, and that's what I consider more advanced. In other words, I wouldn't recommend that you start reading the Churchward without having found a way to initiate yourself into the mystery traditions. You know, he's basically making his entire appeal to the Brotherhood of Freemasonry, which means he's giving no regard to academia whatsoever. And I have to assume that that's because he has deduced that they're simply not mentally prepared for the information that he's bringing forward, because it's arcane. Hmm. And where if you contrast Bailey to, you know, Harold Bailey to Albert Churchward, you'll find that Bailey is making his appeal to academia, whereas Churchward is exclusively making his appeal to the lodge, under the assumption that academia simply is not mentally developed enough to understand the work, which I corroborate, by the way. So, you know, let's just get back a little bit, you know, to this idea of primacy in the North. First thing I want to say about primacy in the North is you're probably not going to hear anybody use that term in that context, and most people may not understand what it means. First thing I'm trying to say about this is I cannot put enough emphasis on how important that is to understand, and it is directly related to the idea of Westing. But Weston constitutes a solar doctrine, which came after the stellar phase of the Egyptian mythology, but it's still related to the same concept of a masculine imbalance. So the idea is that in the early stage of the stellar mythos, they venerated in the southern circumpolar constellations. As they migrated north in the Nile Valley, at the halfway point, they venerated both pole stars as Horus of the double horizon, and that corresponds to double cube, and then double axe, and then brought all the way into the north and stored in Ursa Minor and then the revolving circumpolar constellations, which we talked about in the last show, these seven successive pole stars that succeed in primacy as pole star in the great year cycle. So most people are familiar with the great year cycle and what we know as the precession of the equinox. Well, first thing we have to understand, precession of the equinox constitutes a solar doctrine. And the idea is that the great year cycle can be measured in the solar doctrine by the anti-clockwise movement of the great year cycle falling backwards through the zodiac in the great year cycle through the 12 houses of the zodiac. So in that sense, the age of Pisces, which we're basically in transition to go into Aquarius now, will be succeeded by Aquarius, and that entering in, and that happens about every 2200 years. So if we're transitioning into Aquarius now, then that means roughly 2200 years ago we transitioned out of the age of Aries. So I just mentioned, when we're looking at ram symbolism, especially in Egypt, it can be very confusing, because ram symbolism is such a powerful symbolism to understand, and it's eclectic. So we have to understand it in relation to the beginning of the zodiac in the north. It corresponds to primacy in the north. So that represents the first degree above spring equinox, which is typified by the 3-2-2. So I'm trying not to go fully into ram symbolism right now. I just want to mention it. But see, during the age of Aries, then ram symbolism may have been proliferated everywhere, just to proliferate the propaganda that we're in the age of Aries. Like now we're in the age of Pisces, and the fish is propagated everywhere, or proliferated everywhere. So we have to understand that there's more pure forms of both of those symbols that are exclusive to solar doctrine, which means they're outside of their zodiacal significances. But at the same time, ram symbolism is probably brought into its full grandeur in relation to solar doctrine, because it typifies the beginning of the zodiac and the beginning of the hero myth and all of that. So I'm trying not to go too far ahead, because there's still points I'm trying to make about primacy in the north. I mean, when you bring up a subject like that, just let's make it clear. It's, for one thing, it's one of the primary reasons why the pyramids were built. So when we look at the pyramids, we want to try to remind ourselves that this means primacy in the north. And let that get us started back on our journey on understanding what that means. Well, for one thing, it means a masculine imbalance. And then we have to look at the nature of the masculine principle, which is to dominate, whereas the feminine principle is to be submissive or to submit. So it's no irony that we're being dominated by masculine energy, which we can call solar energy, because that's the nature of the masculine principle. So we have to engage our will and resurrect this generative principle to counterbalance this masculine force, what we can call solar force. And my take on it is that can't be done without understanding our true origins, because for one thing, we can't really understand what's happening in Egypt and what they're endeavoring to do. And as I said, ultimately why these pyramids were built. So let's just say this as kind of a caveat to this, to today's show, is that we're going to be a little bit all over the place today, because these ideas that we're talking about are going to take so much time and so much effort to fully flesh out and understand. We're just continuing to scratch on the surface, you know. Mm-hmm. So let's be patient with it. Let's not get the idea that the question has been answered, because it hasn't. We're discussing it, and we're going to continue to discuss it.
Right. Yeah, and I think these, when talking about these topics, it's really hard to find a real, you know, great place to start. But I do want to say, since we're talking about the ancient Egyptian mythos, when we're talking about, you know, the stellar, the lunar, and the solar cults, the hero cults, you know, this word cult is used and will be used quite a bit on this show, and future shows, especially when we're talking about this mythos. And I was hoping that you could give the listening audience a breakdown of the word cult and where it derives from.
Well, I relate it in relation to agriculture and then ultimately culture. So typically when we hear this word cult, it's a pejorative. But that's only because we don't understand what culture is in a pure form. And there's definitely a deficit in the understanding of culture, even academia and what we call scholarship. So in order to flesh out the pure idea of cult, I would say, the way I would say it is, a cult in a pure form is organic. It's a natural function. It's a vital function. Because ultimately, the idea of a culture is to grow something. So the question as to whether it's going to determine whether or not it's a pejorative or not is going to be determined by what we're growing, something that's benevolent or something that's malevolent, something that's beneficial to us or something that is destructive or something that's, you know, detrimental to us. So it's associated with a group think, and I definitely would caution anybody about group think. But see, what we're really talking about here is we're talking about an enduring civilization, and this is the stellar myth, or the stellar people in the Nile Valley, that they constituted the longest lasting civilization. So most people are unaware of that, that the pinnacle, or the pyramids, were the pinnacle of their achievement. And part of the endeavor, or part of the ambition to build the pyramids, was the awareness that the mythology was going to be ultimately venerated into the annual cycles in order to try to put a finer point on time. And that's what happened. So my point is that the stellar people understood the danger of venerating in annual cycles, primarily the potential to break with chronology, but also the potential to change ideographic types and representative forms that would move us farther away from source. And now we can go back and associate that to the idea of this westing, this moving away from the light, because the moving away from source corresponds to moving away from the light. So part of what I'm saying is the pyramids were built, and it constitutes the pinnacle of the stellar phase of the Egyptian mythos. And part of the reason for building the pyramids was a contingency, because they knew the mythology was going to get transferred into annual cycles. So just like Horus of the Double Horizon was a contingency for primacy in the north, the building of the pyramids was a contingency for primacy in the north, or under the auspices that we would be moving into annual cycles, which is what ultimately did happen. So the main thing I'm trying to say is, in order to understand the word cult in the context of not being a pejorative, the only way that we can understand that is to really understand the stellar culture, who are the pyramid builders, because that represents the longest period of time of a lasting civilization that did not practice socialism, which means any form of coercive government. However, it did, the main thing is it means to grow something. So the question is whether or not it's growing something positive or growing something negative. And let me just mention here, in my first presentation, I break this down and I elaborate on it pretty explicitly. I go into it and try to explain culture in its earliest phases and then how it became corrupted. And the way I described it was that in the first stage, it means to grow something. It's very natural, it's very organic. But in the second stage, culture begins to act as a fire shield, against infiltration by stealth. So the idea is they have these rigid traditions, and then if somebody comes into their territory that doesn't have these traditions, they're going to stand out like a sore thumb because they don't practice their traditions. So in that way, their traditions and their culture is acting as a fire shield. And then in the final stage of culture, it basically acts as a mechanism where the entire society is beating individuality and individualism onto the track of obedience. Like if you're not wearing your face diaper, well, in today's world, that's your yellow star, because that's what culture is doing. It's putting the peer pressure to guilt and shame you for not being in compliance with the authorities.
Right.
So that's how culture is functioning in the modern world. And in that sense, it represents a group think dynamic that represents this pejorative of this term cult. So just to further elaborate a little bit on this idea of this word cult. Main thing, it's typically a pejorative. We have to understand that we're going to continue to be perplexed by this until we understand culture in a pure form. And I'm suggesting that that cannot be done unless we understand the stellar mythos, because that's where culture is in its organic stage. In other words, everything that came after the pyramids were built, while it constitutes part of the evolution of the mythos and the evolution of the learning, it also represents a deviation from source. And as we deviate from source, this corresponds to the idea of Westing, because we're going away from the light. We're going away from the source. So that's part of the dichotomy of understanding this conundrum. And that's part of why we can't really find somebody in archaeology or anthropology that can give us an explicit, direct understanding of culture. But let me just take a minute here so we can just get a standard definition of this word. In modern English, this is a Wikipedia definition, and this is just for convenience. I would never recommend Wikipedia as a bona fide source, and in academia, you're not allowed to use it as a bona fide source, but you can use it to expedite your research. You can use it to be eclectic.
Right.
For convenience sake, we're going to use this definition. In modern English, a cult is a social group that is defined by its unusual religious, spiritual, or physiological beliefs, or by its common interest in a particular personality, object, or goal. This sense of the term is controversial, having divergent definitions both in popular culture and academia, and it has also been an ongoing source of contention among scholars across several fields of study. It is usually considered a pejorative. So basically, it's agreeing with everything that I've said. It's agreeing that there's ambiguity in the word, and that in academia, they don't necessarily agree on the definition, or there is no standard definition. And, part of what I'm saying, without sounding arrogant, is that there's this tremendous ineptitude in academia, as particularly archaeology and the other soft sciences, ultimately psychology. And that the only way that we're really going to understand this term is to understand culture in all of its forms. So we have to find it in a benevolent form in order for it to not always mean or be a pejorative.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll just suggest at this point that everybody check out my first presentation. And towards the end of the presentation, I add in an addendum where I'm fully explaining culture in regards to the evolution of the Egyptian culture, and that the earliest forms of the Egyptian culture represented something organic and absolutely constitute the human species in a state of growth.
Yeah, man. Really great breakdown. It seems to be a very hard topic to understand, but really important nonetheless. We're coming up on the end of this episode, and it's been a real pleasure, Douglas Martin, as always. Was there anything else that you wanted to add in before we end the show?
Well, we can go ahead and wrap it up there for now. It's a good place to wrap it up because I know this is a controversy in people's research, and I think it's an important point. I'm glad you brought it up. So it's a great place to end the show, and I'll look forward to getting back on here in the very near future.
Awesome. Well, guys, our time's up, and we appreciate you giving us your time and attention here on the Cubbyhole Podcast. If you go to our website, cubbyhole.com, that's CubbyHole.com, you'll find more of Douglas Martin's work, along with all the rest of the podcast episodes and news and much more. We hope you've found value in this show today, and please make sure to go back to podcast 8 to better understand this show and future shows with Douglas Martin pertaining to the ancient Egyptian mythos. So stay tuned for more. Thanks, and have a great day.